is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, two leading U.S. Republican presidential hopefuls gaining strength. European Union still seeking answers to migrant crisis. The tallest North American mountain gets a new name.
I'm from Alaska, so I'm really excited. I think this is a great step forward. In Alaska, we've been calling it Denali forever.
A song collaborator goes it alone. These stories and more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. U.S. presidential candidates still have 5 months to wait for their first real test from voters in the Iowa caucus in February. But robust campaigning is going on right now as Republicans try to make their voices heard amid a crowded field seeking that party's nomination. It's going quite well for New York billionaire businessman Donald Trump and Dr. Ben Carson, neither one a professional politician. Both are currently tied in the polls in Iowa. International Edition's Jim Stevenson talked with senior political correspondent Jim Malone about their early success and the significance of the Iowa caucus.
Iowa will kick off the whole process February 1st, 2016. It'll be the Iowa Party precinct caucuses for both Democrats and Republicans, and Iowa has the traditional first state role of opening up the process. That's why there's so much focus now on how people are doing in Iowa. The candidates generally want to get a good starting gate victory if they can, or at least a high finish in places like Iowa and then following in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. How representative is Iowa of the United States as a whole?
Not very demographically representative in terms of ethnicity and race and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's primarily white. But, you know, for both parties, they do put a lot of effort into the vote count in Iowa. And right now, the latest poll conducted by Monmouth University shows that Donald Trump and Ben Carson, two sort of political newcomers, are tied at 23% among Republican-leaning voters in Iowa. Significantly, the third-place finisher is Carly Fiorina, also a political neophyte. So what's interesting is right now people seem to be looking for, especially on the Republican side, political outsiders. Trump certainly fits that. Whether he can hold on is anyone's guess, but right now, the Donald Trump train doesn't show any signs of slowing down.
It's been quite an interesting campaign to watch so far, and very entertaining, too. I mean, a lot of people say, well, there doesn't seem to be much substance. He hasn't really answered a lot of hard questions, but people seem to resonate with what he's saying.
You know, there's another Quinnipiac survey that came out today about sort of voter attitudes around the country that found that 71% of American voters right now are dissatisfied with the way things are going in the country, including 41% who are very dissatisfied. That gives some insight, perhaps, into why Trump has sustained this momentum. There is a group that's very angry and frustrated, and it's kind of like they're venting through him. Mm-hmm. And they like the fact he's very blunt-spoken and that he's not really moderating his language very much, even when he comes under attack.
It's fascinating with Dr. Ben Carson, because here you have a neurosurgeon who's been at Johns Hopkins University for a long time in Baltimore, and that now seems to be resonating with voters without any political
background. Completely different style than Donald Trump, but, you know, he's the only African-American in the race in either party. And he seems to be resonating, again, with voters looking for something different, something beyond the sort of pat talking points we get from so many of the politicians. Those folks have sort of dropped down in the ranking of voters in places like Iowa. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, has slipped considerably. There just seems to be a yearning right now among Republicans for somebody or something different, and it's being sustained for the foreseeable future. Again, I think a lot of Trump's rivals keep waiting for him to kind of blow up somehow, that he's going to self-destruct. But there's no sign of that happening anytime soon. If anything, his favorable, unfavorable poll numbers have actually switched around now in Iowa. He was very, you know, viewed unfavorably by a lot of people just a few months ago, but he's been able to turn that around. So in one sense, we don't know what the ceiling is for Donald Trump right now.
two very contrasting styles and two identical numbers in the polls right now. That should spell for a fascinating time in Iowa.
It's really got a long way to sort out. The next debate is in the middle of September. We'll know more then, perhaps. Maybe we won't. It's a wide open field with a huge field and no end in sight.
VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Turning now to social media reaction, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us what people are tweeting in terms of Iowa. Hi, G.
Hi, Ray. Let's start with Donald Trump because, as always, he's in the spotlight just the way he likes it. He wrote this tweet earlier Monday. Leading in the Bloomberg Iowa poll. Also, my favorability numbers went up at a record, almost unheard of clip. Thank you, Iowa. That's been retweeted 1,330 times and marked as a favorite more than 4,000 times.
And what about Dr. Ben Carson? How's he doing?
Ray, like you said earlier, he's tied in the polls with Trump in Iowa, and you can tell from his Twitter account that he's ecstatic about it. He shared a number of tweets from media outlets on the news. The first one is from ABC News Politics, and it reads like this. New Monmouth University poll shows at Real Ben Carson tied for lead with at Real Donald Trump in Iowa at 23%.
What can you tell us about their social media prowess?
Well, let's focus on their Twitter presence for now. As many of our listeners know, Trump has been a household name in America for some time, thanks to his company's brand and TV shows. That may be part of a reason why he has nearly 4 million followers on Twitter. He has been on Twitter since 2009. Carson, on the other hand, is relatively new to Twitter, joining it just 2 years ago. He has 532,000 followers, so literally a fraction of the number of followers Trump has. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee, thanks. You can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's J-E-E-A-B-B-E-Y-L-E-E. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition coming to you from Washington. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is calling on other countries in Europe to do more to share the burden of the thousands of migrants streaming into the continent. But some of Germany's neighbors are resisting her appeal. Germany's accepted more refugees than any other European country, a total that could reach 800,000 by the end of the year. But Slovakia, the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland are among countries that are blocking a plan for European Union member states to accept specific numbers of refugees. Vienna tightened its security checks after the bodies of 71 migrants were discovered last week in Austria in an abandoned truck. European Union interior ministers plan to meet in Brussels September 14th to discuss the migration crisis. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Joel Millman, press officer of the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, about what specific issues might be raised during the meeting.
Well, I think the regulations, I think the kind of adjustments that Europe is you know, feeling its way towards now, which, by the way, we consider a very good thing. I mean, the migrant surge that's come through across the Mediterranean over the last 2 years has really put in sharp focus, you know, what works and what doesn't work, where Europe's performing well and where it needs some rethinking. So we were assuming that some of that thinking is going to be done out loud at this minister's meeting, which is on a list of things that we consider positive developments despite all the negative news in the last few weeks.
What about human trafficking? If the interior ministers are going to get together and talk about things along with border security, should human trafficking be high on the list?
Well, it should be. You know, one of the things that came out last week in the tragedy that occurred in Austria was that it happened 15 years almost to the date of a similar tragedy, 58 killed in Dover, the famous Dover incident where 60 Chinese were found trapped in a truck that crossed the English Channel or came in from, I think, from Belgium across the North Sea. And it was very, you know, it's known as sort of the incident that started the Palermo Protocol and the talks that where the UN targeted, you know, human smuggling. And we, one of our IOM chiefs of mission in Europe said this tragedy this week shows that 15 years later, not enough has been done. So clearly, I mean, this is something on their agenda to start thinking about and think about what they haven't accomplished in the last 15 years.
Obviously, in some countries, the pushback against this migration wave is substantial. The British Home Secretary, Theresa May, who has come out with a statement that EU-free movement should mean the freedom to move to a job, not to look for work or for benefits. She claims that would be a return to the original principle of free movement in the EU. What's your reaction to her?
Well, you know, we've noticed for a while that you know, politicians have learned to attract votes on the backs of migrants, usually negatively. It's not unusual. It happens in every country. Migrants are, almost by definition, the least powerful in a political situation, political you know, community. They don't tend to have a vote. They often are not even possessing documents that make them legal in the country. So beating up on them legally and as well as rhetorically is something that politicians find is pretty easy to do and costs them very little. So we kind of overlook the noise and just say they keep coming. They know how to integrate. There are all kinds of solutions that immigrants come up with, legal and sometimes extra legal, to fix their status in a country. So we want politicians to sort of stop wasting everyone's time bashing and start thinking about managing and how to do it, because there's lots of benefits to gain from this for both sides, and they just need to stop getting cheap political wins on something that really has very little consequence to them.
Joel Millman, press officer for the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Scientists with the U.S. National Aeronautics and Space Administration say warming waters and melting ice mean it is fairly certain that the planet is locked in to about a 1 meter rise in sea levels by the year 2100. VOA's Steve Herman in Bangkok spoke with NASA Administrator Charles Bolden about a new program in the lower Mekong region to help cope with climate change. Mr. Bolden was asked how the project will benefit the people of Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, Thailand, and Vietnam.
One of the greatest benefits to people in the lower Mekong region, you know, coming all the way from Vietnam down through Laos, Thailand, Cambodia, even Myanmar, is the fact that it makes available to them 30 years worth of archived Earth science data plus daily real-time data coming from Earth observing satellites that look at things that can help policymakers and farmers with crop planning, water resources management, disaster relief, disaster management. And also in things like drought and flood planning. So we think it will be of great benefit to people here in the entire Mekong region.
Now, how is this going to work operationally? Will there be Thais and Vietnamese and Cambodians, Laotians, yes, that are involved in this?
Operationally, it's a program that is focused within the or under the auspices of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and they actually have a center that's located here in Bangkok, which is the home for the Mekong Hub. They will work across the region with government representatives, with hopefully people who represent the farming community or policymakers in that nature, to coordinate how the data is utilized and how the various nations collaborate with each other, such that The actions taken by one nation are beneficial to others in the region. So I relate it sometimes to the way we do things on the International Space Station, where we have almost 20 different nations collaborating every single day in trying to help us understand better how we live and work in space. SERVEER serves in a similar way that helps us bring nations together who might not otherwise want to work with each other, but it works on a common focus of making life better for people here in the Mekong region.
NASA Administrator Charles Bolden talking with VOA's Steve Herman in Bangkok. The depredations of the Islamic State group in Syria and Iraq against monuments, archaeological treasures, and thousands of innocent people have drawn outrage from around the world. No group has suffered more than the religious minority known as Yazidis, a couple of people not widely known outside the Middle East. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports from Houston, Texas, an American University graduate student who spent time with the Yazidis in Iraq is championing their cause.
As Kurdish forces continue their fight against jihadists in northern Iraq, thousands of Yazidis continue to live in UN refugee camps. One of their biggest advocates in the United States is Matthew Barber, a graduate student at the University of Chicago. In a Skype interview, Barber spoke of how Yazidis felt betrayed when IS invaded Sinjar in Iraqi Kurdistan last year.
The Kurdish forces, the Peshmerga, that were responsible for defending Sinjar, they fled before the jihadists reached the area. So Yazidis were left vulnerable. They were abandoned by the forces of the government that claims to protect them.
Barber says widespread prejudice against Yazidis has not stopped many Kurdish Muslims from displaying goodwill.
When the displaced Yazidis were flooding into the city of Dohuk, there were many people, neighbors there, who were coming out to their communities, bringing food, supplies, clothing. These were Muslims coming to visit Yazidis. I saw Islamic religious leaders coming out and pledging their support.
Kurdistan's government has pledged to avenge the Yazidis and has deployed troops to drive IS out of occupied areas. Many Yazidis say they would like to leave Iraq and live in Europe or the United States, but Barber says this would be a loss for the land they leave.
It may mean the disappearance of an important element of the diversity of the region.
Yazidi immigrants in the United States and elsewhere are trying to build communities and preserve traditions, but Barber says they leave important things behind.
The Yazidis have traditional holy places and shrines, and if they leave the region, they migrate out of Iraq, it does irreparable damage to their tradition.
Immigrant Yazidis here in Houston and elsewhere say they're doing what they can to preserve their traditions, but their main concern now is preserving the lives of people back in their homeland. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
The tallest mountain in the United States and all of North America is getting a new name. President Obama announced Monday that the more than 6,000-meter-tall Mount McKinley in Alaska will now be called Mount Denali, a name used by generations of Alaskan Natives, or First Americans, and it means the Great One. The White House describes the name change as an effort to align the policies of the federal government with how Native Alaskans have long referred to the mountain. The renaming came during Mr. Obama's first day of a three-day tour of Alaska to bring attention to climate change. VOA Susan Yaki spoke about the decision with Jackie Potta of the National Congress of American Indians.
I'm from Alaska, so I'm really excited. I think this is a great step forward in Alaska. We've been calling it Denali forever. So.
And what does it mean to the Alaskan people?
Well, I think it really shows that, you know, in Alaska, we really care about Alaskans. And this is the desire of Alaskans. It's the traditional name in Alaskans. You know, President McKinley never came to Alaska, and I recognize wanting to honor him with the highest, you know, the mountain with the highest peak in the North America. But I think this just really allows this mountain to be represented as what it is, which is an Alaska name and Alaska mountain.
Well, John Boehner, Speaker of the House, he's a Republican, as you know, and he said in a press release, and I'll quote it, McKinley served our country with distinction during the Civil War as a member of the Army. He made a difference for his constituents and his state as a member of the House of Representatives and as governor of the great state of Ohio, and he led this nation to prosperity and victory in the Spanish-American War as the 25th president of the United States. And he says he's deeply disappointed. What is your reaction to Mr. Boehner's comments?
Well, my reaction is, you know, Alaskans are really a different kind of breed of people, and we really care about things that are from Alaska, you know, that are Alaskan. And I think it's, you know, time to represent how Alaskans feel about something within their own state. I mean, this is the historic and traditional name. Restoring it to its historic and traditional name and honoring Alaska Natives as well as Alaskans, I think it's the right thing to do.
Some people say it's President Obama reaching out to the people of Alaska and the American Indians who haven't seen a lot of presidents visiting.
I think this has been a debate that's been going on for 30-plus years. The fact that it's happening when President Obama happens to be here just says the significance of just putting to bed some of these old issues and resolving them in favor of Alaskans.
Jackie Potta of the National Congress of American Indians speaking with International Edition Susan Yockey. Life expectancy is improving. People are living longer. But there is a downside. The bad news is the longer you live, the bigger the risk for poor health. VOA's Joe DiCapua explains.
Around the world, life expectancy has risen by 6 years since 1990. A new study says much of that is due to advances against HIV/AIDS and malaria. In addition, progress has been made in reducing deaths from communicable diseases and maternal, newborn, and nutritional disorders. The top 10 places with the highest life expectancies are Japan, Singapore, Andorra, which is a microstate near Spain and France, Iceland, and Cyprus, followed by Israel, France, Italy, South Korea, and Canada. The U.S. ranks 34th in the World Health Organization's rankings for life expectancy. That's believed due to a wide range of health issues among a diverse population. Teo Voss is the lead author of the study. He's a professor of global health at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington. Voss says there's been a marked reduction in mortality rates from almost all causes.
Most importantly, all the infectious diseases that affect young children, the neonatal problems, so the problems following birth. But we've also seen very steady declines in injury deaths, and the rates of mortality from some of the big non-communicable diseases are slowly, or a bit more than slowly, declining as well.
For many, however, the quality of life in those extra years may be marred by health problems.
You increase the average lifespan of people, and with increasing age, you are more likely to get diseases that impair your ability to function.
Voss says some diseases and disabilities can be prevented, but he says investment in treating or curing them has not kept pace with investments for major diseases. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
9 out of 10 countries with the lowest life expectancies are in Southern Africa. Lesotho is the worst, with a life expectancy of just 42 years. Singer Ruby Amanfu is known for her collaborations with other artists, including Patti LaBelle, Kelly Clarkson, and White Stripes singer-guitarist Jack White. But now she's going it alone. International Edition's David Byrd looks at the singer, who covers Bob Dylan, Kanye West, and others, on her new solo CD called Standing Still.
Ruby Amanfu's father moved their family from Ghana to Nashville, Tennessee, when she was only 3. She showed talent as early as 3rd grade when she won a pack of gumballs for singing in a school talent show. Nashville is where music critics began to notice her talent a decade or so later. It's also where she met fellow musician Sam Brooker. The two became Sam and Ruby and went on to complete a selection of songs that became their first EP. The Associated Press called their 2009 album, The Here and the Now, the best album of the year.
I'm walking away from my past pride. The here and the now's what we'll make right. If we get to see.
Now Ruby Amanfu has a new CD, Standing Still, which covers several top names, including Bob Dylan and Kanye West. She chose their more obscure tunes so that people could hear her instead of the original recordings.
And I wanted this to feel like a discovery for the listener. Even if they do know the artist, they may not know the song, and I want them to also feel a discovery listening to me for the first time, because these songs are really personal to me, and I want to share my personal story in those songs.
The album was recorded in 5 days in a rural Tennessee log cabin. Ruby says that the beauty of making the album that way with producer Mark Howard, a six-piece band, and guest producers, including the Black Keys' Patrick Carney, is that it felt very organic.
You can wake up in the morning and record, and then you can have lunch and record, and then have dinner and record, and maybe have a glass of wine and do something else if you're in the mood. So, you know, instead of having a normal session where you come in and you're on the clock and, you know, you get one or two down, it was a really great way to do it, and that's why we got so much materials, because everyone was just in the same space and really relaxed.
Ruby Amanfu is known for her high-profile collaborations with other artists. She hopes that her fans can hear all she has learned from others in her solo CD.
I'm excited for the support that I already have from the fans who have been with me in those other forms, and I hope that they are proud of what I have to give now, because I feel that learning so much from all of those partnerships has only made me stronger as an individual artist.
Ruby Amanfu's new album, Standing Still, is out this month. I'm David Byrd.
Down, down, how I long to be.
That'll do it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
August 29th marked the four-year anniversary of the detention in Iran of U.S. citizen Amir Hekmati on false charges of espionage. Mr. Hekmati, a former U.S. Marine who was born in Arizona, was arrested by Iranian authorities when he traveled to Iran in 2011 to visit relatives. In a statement, Secretary of State John Kerry again called on the government of Iran to release Amir Hekmati on humanitarian grounds. This is a milestone no family wants to mark, he said. The Hekmati family has shown inspiring perseverance in the face of this injustice. And, as befits a former Marine, Amir has shown tremendous courage in the face of this unjust detention. Secretary Kerry noted that President Barack Obama recently told a group of American veterans that he would not relent in efforts to bring Mr. Hekmati home. In that speech, Mr. Obama spoke of all the Americans who are unjustly detained in Iran.
Journalist Jason Rezaian should be released. Pastor Saeed Abedini should be released. Amir Hekmati, a former sergeant in the U.S. Marine Corps, should be released. Iran needs to help us find Robert Levinson. These Americans need to be back home with their families.
Secretary of State Kerry also called on the government of Iran to release Saeed Abedini and Jason Rezaian, as well as Mr. Hekmati, and to work cooperatively with the United States to locate Robert Levinson so that all can be returned to their families.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.